Since court rulings struck down mandatory life in prison without parole sentences for juvenile offenders, Massachusetts has granted parole to 11 men over the past 2 years. Many of them were incarcerated for decades and never thought they'd be released. We're now going to hear from two parolees who have been outside, as they say, for just a few months.
Everybody I meet, they say, I never would have guessed you were in prison. You don't look like a convict.
Greg Diachenko is pleased when people tell him that, and somewhat surprised, because he was in prison for more than 34 years. Now 52 years old, clean-cut and soft-spoken, it is hard to believe that at age 17, Diachenko was convicted of murder. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
It's just a tragic event that happened. You know, it wasn't meant to happen, but it did. And I'm sorry for that. I can't do anything to change it.
Diachenko was convicted of fatally stabbing 55-year-old Thomas Wharf in 1981. During his parole hearing, Diachenko said Wharf propositioned him and he got into Wharf's car planning to rob him. But, Diachenko says, when he showed Wharf his knife, Wharf grabbed him and slammed on the car horn. Wharf was stabbed 9 times.
I mean, I know a lot of people don't want me out, okay? They think that I should rot in prison for the rest of my life. But the parole board saw otherwise. Let's give him a second chance. I think I deserve that second chance.
The U.S. Supreme Court determined that juveniles like Diachenko did deserve another chance. In 2012, the justices struck down automatic sentences of life without parole for juveniles. Diachenko then filed a petition with the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court challenging the constitutionality of state law requiring such sentences. In December of 2013, the SJC struck down those sentences in a ruling named after Diachenko.
But I'm not the same person that went in at 17 years old. I went in there, I was young, I was stupid. I made terrible choices, not just regarding my crime, but prior to that, you know, dropping out of school, my alcoholism. I was more into drinking and getting high than studying and hitting the books.
Eventually, Diachenko did start studying, completing high school and getting a bachelor's degree in prison. He also worked as a plumber at MCI Norfolk for decades. Diachenko says when he first got to prison, he was arrogant and he often got into fights. But he says eventually he learned to stay out of trouble.
Prison is violent. If you want to get mixed up in that, though, it's really no different than society itself. Society's violent. There's killings out here, there's robberies. That same thing happens inside. There's drugs, if you want them. But a person can do their time quietly. You just fall back and stay away from all the trouble.
But another so-called juvenile lifer had a different experience growing up in prison. Now 41 years old, Joe Donovan says his more than 2 decades in prison were often violent, and young offenders especially had to quickly learn how to be tough. Donovan says it was particularly difficult at MCI Cedar Junction, formerly MCI Walpole, which had a notorious reputation.
I went to the worst prison in the state, and I very quickly surmised what I had to do. And, you know, made mistakes along the way, a few here and there, and I caught on pretty quick and kind of lived the life I thought I had to live to survive in a long-term fashion there.
For Donovan, that meant largely keeping to himself, which wasn't so difficult because he was often in solitary confinement. Like Diachenko, Donovan was also 17 when he was convicted of murder. He was charged with the killing of MIT student Yngwie Raustein. Donovan admitted to throwing the first punch when he and 2 other teens walked by Raustein in Cambridge in 1992. But the then 15-year-old who fatally stabbed Raustein was sentenced in juvenile court and was released years ago. Because Donovan was tried as an adult, he was sentenced to life.
Does the night of the crime still haunt you?
Yes, I always think about that. I still am mad at myself for punching somebody that I should have never punched, and I can't really give you a good reason why I did it, right? To this day, all I can basically say is I was just a stupid kid, and I wish it was a good enough reason, but it really isn't, you know? But that's like the only thing I can really come up with. I wasn't in my rational state of mind. I'm not in the mind that set that I'm in now.
The Massachusetts Parole Board granted Donovan parole in August of 2014. After serving almost 2 years in lower security facilities, he moved into a halfway house in Boston in June. His parole requirements include random drug and alcohol testing, regularly checking in with his parole officer and a counselor, and getting a job. Although not easy with his criminal record, Donovan says he remains optimistic.
It's good. I'm happy, right? And one thing I've always told my lawyer, and I always joke about it, like I'll say, well, you know, it's hard to find a good job. And he says, well, Joe, you know, these are all good problems to have. Right? And really, like, my worst problem is still a good problem to have.
Both Donovan and Diachenko have found custodial jobs, and they're learning how to do something they have never done before, live on their own as adults in a world that's changed dramatically since they went to prison. As they learn about new things like computers and cell phones, they're also relearning things. Interestingly, they both had a similar experience this summer. Here is Diachenko.
When I dove in, I had forgotten how to swim. It was crazy. I came up, and I was, like, panicking, and I came to the surface, and I was like, what happened? I used to swim so good, and I started just doggy paddling back to shore.
Tomorrow, we'll look at what Diachenko and Donovan are doing to adjust to their new and unexpected freedom. To see photos, you can go to our website, WBUR.org. In Massachusetts and four other states, one of the hottest topics this election season is marijuana. Voters will decide whether it should be legal for recreational use and regulated like alcohol. One of the key points in the debate is marijuana's effects on the brain. WBUR's Martha Biebinger reports.
An 8-point drop in IQ. That's the effect of using pot more than once a week on a small group of New Zealanders who started in their teens and were tested again at age 38. That study, released in 2012, rocked research on marijuana. Critics pounced because the study did not adjust for many things that affect IQ, home life, education, and family income. One of those critics, Nicholas Jackson, wondered what would happen if he compared twins.
Individuals that share the same genes grew up in the same household, where the difference between them is that one of the twins was using marijuana and the other twin was not.
Jackson, with the University of Southern California, compared IQ tests of twins age 9 to 12 before either had smoked marijuana and then 7 to 10 years later after one had started.
If marijuana was causing IQ decline, what we would expect to see is that the twin who goes on and uses marijuana should have IQ deficits. We don't find that.
IQ scores for both twins went up and down within just 2 points. And for the twin who smoked marijuana, there was no significant difference between daily and occasional use. So was the New Zealand finding wrong? The author did not comment for this story, but has said that the twin study of teenagers does not address the effects of decades-long heavy marijuana use. Whether it's the twins or the New Zealanders, marijuana seems to affect a particular kind of intelligence, like what you'd learn in school, says Mitch Earlywine with the University of Albany.
They haven't learned a whole lot of vocabulary words or the capital of Maine because they were high at school that day. But when it comes to things that are more liquid intelligence, more fluid intelligence, they're usually pretty good at those because it requires just intelligence in the moment, so to speak.
It's not clear how marijuana may keep Augusta from being filed next to capital of Maine. Some studies that compare brain scans of teenagers who use marijuana and those who don't show thinner, less dense connections between lobes. Nora Volkoff, director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, says brains with less connectivity don't work as well as they should.
You could expect that that will decrease your capacity to memorize things and to learn them, which is necessary for you to actually further develop your cognitive abilities.
There's little proof that marijuana causes poor brain connections. Maybe kids who are already having trouble in school are more likely to try marijuana. Still, Volkoff is convinced marijuana is bad for the brains of adults who begin smoking in their youth.
Teenagers that smoke regularly marijuana are achieving much less both in their education as well as their profession as well as their economic earnings. they also tend to be much more dissatisfied with life. Many studies have shown that.
But if you don't start young and don't use marijuana often, there's not much evidence of permanent harm to the brain. Even some experts in marijuana brain science say it might be okay to make pot legal with strong oversight. Dr. Kevin Hill is with Harvard Medical School.
I'm not sure how I would vote at this point. I want to see sensible marijuana policy that works, that gives people what they want while limiting risk.
If Massachusetts approves marijuana for recreational use, it would be for adults age 21 and older, after most brain development is complete. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Martha Biebinger.
It's time now for the Remembrance Project, our weekly look at the extraordinary lives of ordinary people from our community. This morning, writer Alyssa Eli remembers a man who grew up in Wayland but spent most of his life in Colorado.
Making goals for himself and others was one art Jonathan Greenleaf practiced. Another, as he liked to put it, was crushing them. His goals were highly diversified. Fitness was one, and a reason he moved to Boulder after a year of college on the East Coast. Professional exactitude was another. Long before he became a carpenter, at age 5 or 6, he had his own workbench and used his father's tools to take apart things he mostly put back together. In Boulder, Jonathan became known as the handyman on the hill, papering that college town with flyers that couldn't be ignored.
Did you party like a rock star this year? Of course you did. Do you have a couple holes in your walls or broken lamps to prove, to show for it? Don't let your landlord overcharge you or, like, keep your deposit, you know? Like, call me. You know, I've got these really fair prices. And, like, it's just very funny.
The leaflets did the trick, his twin sister, Sarah Greenleaf, remembers. But eventually, the handyman grew serious and opened Greenleaf Construction, LLC. Jonathan's perfectionism was a challenge to his productivity, but no matter, his customers became his friends. A day would begin with work in someone's kitchen and end with dinner around their dining room table. That's how he was, exuberantly all in. During the Boulder flood of 2013, he worked sleeplessly on emergency repairs, pumping water out of houses.
I mean, he just loved being with people, and he just loved people so much, and he just always wanted the best for his friends, for his people.
Bringing people together was a goal, too. It probably had biological beginnings. Jonathan and Sarah had been together since birth. They used to hold hands in adjacent high chairs. Neither made a move without consultation. They were best friends, cheerleaders for each other, and collaborators.
I just feel so lucky that I got to be his twin, because he helped define me. He helped grow me into the person that I am today. Different qualities about myself that come directly from him, from his encouragement and his support and his love. And I know I did the same thing for him, too.
It took a year of high fevers and vision loss to diagnose Jonathan's rare blood disease. A fundraiser for his medical expenses, he called it Green Stock, might have been the summit of his organizational genius.
It really helped bring Jonathan back to life. He was in a coma for a little while, and he was very, very sick with his HLH. And all of a sudden, the treatment started working, and he came out of it. He woke up, and so he said, let's celebrate.
He took complete control. Greenstock was held in a Boulder brewery. 3 bands, an auction, donated art. And the goals board, unfilled slips of paper with 3 questions. What's your goal? When would you like to meet it by? And do you want Jonathan to check back with you on it?
Jonathan's goal, of course, was to beat HLH. Finish treatment, and get healthy again.
By the end of the night, the board was a dream work of photos and intentions, a promotion, a new dog, cutting out sugar.
So I've put all those goals into an Excel sheet, and I still haven't, but intend to reach out to everyone and do what Jonathan really wanted to do, which was just follow up and make sure that they've accomplished their goal.
Jonathan died several months later after returning to Boston. He'd planned to crush his goal. and he came as close as was humanly possible.
Writer Alyssa Eli, remembering Jonathan Greenleaf, who died a year ago at the age of 30. To suggest someone for a remembrance, you can email remember@wbur.org.